I said, well, how late are you working? 11:30, 12. On school nights? Yes, sir. I said, how many hours do you work a week? 40. I said, you work 40 hours a week and go to school full time? Yes, sir. Anchoring a corner of that baggie is his senior ring. And I'm watching the doctor pass this to this grieving mother. It's one of the most devastating scenes, you know, of my career. And of course, beautiful and devastating at the same time. He saw the value that Jorge's community and that Jorge's school placed on him. I mean, he saw that it was real. You can't manufacture that kind of thing. And he saw that the community, the school, the institution that he attended placed that value on his friend. Mm-hmm. And he knew that he had that value as well.
What does it mean to live a life of purpose? For Steve Strasley, the answer lies in showing up over and over again for the people who need you.
Welcome to the Carti Hopecast, where we explore stories that shape us, journeys of resilience, hope, and perseverance. We seek the lessons that emerge when we face the unexpected and find strength in the struggle.
I'm Adam Head, and today I have the honor to sit down with Steve Strasley, educator, writer, and head of Catholic High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. Steve's commitment to loyalty, mentorship, and community has quietly shaped the lives of thousands. His journey invites us to ask how we show up for others and for ourselves. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thanks
today.
For having me.
Yeah,
glad to be
to the
here.
Hopecast.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, I want to jump in and begin at the beginning, so to speak. You've spent your entire life in Little Rock. What does the city of Little Rock mean to you?
Oh, gosh. Where do I start? I love our city. I think that Little Rock has the potential to be extraordinary in every regard. It is, just the people, the natural resources, the opportunities for businesses to thrive and invest and so forth. It is just, one of those mid-sized southern towns that has all these great opportunities that we have just got to focus on and realize that, there's going to be some gritty parts, and that's good. That's what life is. And the points where we can make it better and improve upon it, we need to do that. So,
you're certainly doing that, and I can't wait to get into some of this and how you're living that out day to day. And so you've worn many hats in your time: teacher, principal, head of school, columnist.
Yeah.
If someone asked you, who is Steve Strasley? What would you say? How would you answer that?
Oh, man. That's a great question for any man to answer, right? I'm the son of great parents. Where one side was shaped by, a German experience, so to speak, and the other an Irish experience, so to speak. So definitely have that German work ethic and the Irish love of people. I'm a son of Little Rock. Again, I love this city. I see this city becoming extraordinary. It is just, again, just so on the cusp of doing something profound. And it's doing so many things very, very well. And I'm proud to be part of it. I'm the son of Catholic High. It is the institution that shaped me more than any other institution that I can think of. I started there as a 14-year-old in 1984, graduated in 1988, returned as a teacher in 1992, and, have essentially been there ever since. I'm a father. I have my own sons and daughters. I have a wife who is a much better person than me, and makes me a better person just being around her. So you know, yeah, I wear a lot of hats, and really I'm fortunate and smart enough to soak in these people that have surrounded me and the experiences that I've had to make a life out of it.
Well, also leadership mm-hmm. has been a critical part of your journey, and I wanted to talk about that a moment. Your path to leadership wasn't planned.
No.
Perhaps even as you just described it, you intended to study law, but a one-time teaching contract, it changed everything for you.
Right.
What did you discover in the classroom that made you stay and continue to invest?
Yeah. I was about to graduate college. I had a law school spot. That's where I was going. But I thought it was like February, March of my senior year. And I thought, you know, I kind of want to do something different for a year. And so I called Father Tribu, my old high school rector, principal, and English teacher. And I called him in the middle of the night. Well, middle of the night, it was 9 o'clock. And I didn't expect him to answer. He answered. I said, "Father, is Steve Stracely?" And he goes, "Are you in jail?" I was like, "Father, why would you ask that?"
That's the first thought.
But apparently he gets a lot of calls like that. Sure. And I said, "No, sir, I'm about to graduate. And I wondered if you would have any teaching positions open." Mm. And he goes, "Nah, are you certified?" I go, "No, but I mean, I'll do whatever, you know, you want me to." And he goes, "Well, what's your major?" I said, "It's history." And there was this long pause. And he says, "I just had a history teacher come in today to ask for a one-year sabbatical." Mm. And I said, "Father, I want to stay 1 year. I'm deferring law school. I want to go to law school after this."
Wow.
And he goes, "I think we need to talk." Mm-hmm. And so came in, talked, and got the job. People ask me, you know, "When did you know you wanted to be a teacher?" About 3 months into teaching is when I figured out I wanted to be a teacher. You know, it's a hard job. It's confrontational in some respects. It's time consuming. You talk about wearing a lot of hats. I mean, you wear a lot of hats in the classroom on a daily basis. And about 3 months in, I thought, you know, I can do this. And these kids, you know, they're idiots half the time, and you know, beautiful souls the other half of the time. And yeah. I want to be part of this. Mm. And so at the end of that first year, Father Tribu said, you know, I still have a spot for you if you want to stay one more. And I said, "All right, I'll stay one more." And that was about 30 years ago. So here I am.
I want to go back to your early life, Steve.
Yeah.
Growing up, I understand your family had an impactful experience when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that and maybe what you learned about resilience in that season?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to, you know, overplay this, but, you know, my dad worked for a bank in Little Rock, mm-hmm. and he and a bunch of other mid-level executives were laid off at mm-hmm. one point. And so my dad was without a job. Mm-hmm. Five kids in our family. He is a self-made man. And so suddenly he's unemployed. And of course, you know, with five mouths to feed and educate and everything else, it was a really, you know, big shift for us and our mindset as a family. So, and again, you know, kids grow up without dads in the house and so forth. I mean, they go through tragedy. So, you know, please understand that I'm fortunate and feel that I'm fortunate in the life that I had as a kid. Sure. But this was a moment in our family's life where things pivoted. And so my dad got a job out of state, and he wanted us to grow up in Little Rock. He wanted us to attend Catholic High. And he wanted us to have this experience of, you know, the bigger picture of Little Rock and mm-hmm. the Catholic schools here. And so he would leave on Sunday night go work and then come back on Friday night. And so my mom found herself, you know, a single mom during those 5 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, money was tight. And we realized as kids, you know, I was 13, 14 years old, that we have got to pull together and make this work. And we've got to do our part. And so what I've learned from that is that, you know, the whole is always better than the single piece. I learned that a work ethic is invaluable. You know, you may not be the smartest person in the room, but you can outwork everybody if you put your mind to it. And that has great value in it. I learned that, you know, laughter is as important as an arm or a leg, that you have got to find humor in the small parts of life. And I learned that, you know, trouble is temporary. You know, it has a shelf life. And what you do with that trouble, you know, how you make it better, that's what impacts you forever.
Really foundational for you.
Absolutely.
What happened years later. You've been fortunate enough to shape the lives of thousands of students, literally at this point. Can you talk perhaps about a moment when you saw a student's life pivot because they just needed somebody to believe in them?
Yeah, you know, that's the gift of being in education, is that every teacher has, you know, the Rolodex of those kids. And that's what makes teachers come back every year, you know. And I think of one that just epitomized it. There was this boy several years ago who was just hell on wheels. He was acting up in the classrooms. He wouldn't come to school. His mom would call me and, hey, I can't get him out of bed. Can you talk to him? Like, yeah, put the phone by his ear. And he put it, and I'd go, hey, get to school. Your mother wants you to come to school. And we'd, you know, I'd yell into the phone, and he'd come in, and he was just put out. He didn't want to be there, constantly acting up. And I was constantly having interactions with him like that. And, one time, you know, we had gotten into it about something. And I mean, this is one of those kids that just no effect, you know, you can't yell at him. You can't say I'm disappointed in him. It doesn't matter. It just no effect. And I thought, you know, one day I just said, you know what? On the last day of school or after graduation, you and I are going to go into the back parking lot and have a fist fight. I was kidding. And the kid looks at me and he goes, oh, I look forward to that, Mr. Straisley. I look forward to that. And I went, oh, geez, what have I done? So anyway, he was a tough kid. And he had this friend. His best friend was this kid named Jorge. And another tough situation, but this great kid. And I met Jorge because I took a knife off of him one day. He was sophomore, junior year. He was we were doing a blood drive, and he was untucking his shirt, and one of the teachers saw he had a knife stuck in his belt, and he was about to donate blood, and you know, we catch him with this knife, and he comes in, and I said, "What are you doing with a knife?" And he kind of got stoic, and he said, "It's for protection." I said, "For protection? I've seen your classmates; they're not that tough." And he said, he said, I work late. And when I come home, the men in my trailer park have been drinking. They sit around in the courtyard and they drink. And I come home and I go into my house or go into my place, and they beat on the door and they try to talk to my mom and my sister. And and he said, I'm the man of the house.
Wow.
I need that protection. I said, well, how late are you working? 11:30, 12. On school nights? Yes, sir. I said, how many hours do you work a week? 40. Wow. I said, you work 40 hours a week and go to school full time? Yes, sir. I said, well, we're going to do two things. I said, number one, you are suspended. You can't bring a knife to school. Nobody can do that. I said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I understand. I said, but number two, you're going to start working here. You'll start right after school. We always hire students. You're the student we're going to hire, and you're going to work so that you get off early. You're going to get home early, and you're going to be able to take care of your studies better. And we're going to pay you in a way that makes up for, you know, those 40 hours and so forth. Oh, yes, sir. Yes, thank you. I said, but you're going to learn your job, because when you're suspended, you're going to be doing manual labor, learning how to do that job. He said, oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Wow. So he, you know, just, you know, became part of the fabric of the school. He already was, but now he's like the inside kid. Like, he's the one who's fixing lockers, taking care of things and so forth. So right before our senior ring mass, this is one of the most important, if not the most important ceremony we have. Our senior ring to us is more than a piece of jewelry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a key to our home. You know, everybody has the exact same senior ring. My senior ring looks exactly like the kids who get it today. And I came up to him and I asked him, it just dawned on me, maybe he didn't buy one, you know, and I was going to make sure that he had the funding to do so. Mm-hmm. And I walked up to him. I said, hey, did you get a senior ring? He said, looked at me like I was an idiot. I said, of course I did. I earned that. Paid for in full.
Wow.
I said, okay, okay. And he goes, I earned that ring. I agree. You earned that ring. So tragically, a couple months later, I get a call, and it's another student. He says, there's been a car wreck. Jorge's car ran out of gas. He's in the median. A car came up behind him and hit him. And he's at the hospital, and they can't find his mother. And so I went to the hospital and told them, you know, I'm not a relative, but I can help you find them. And so they let me in, and I called an uncle who spoke English, who found mom. Mom came up there, and the doctor is talking to the mom, and I can see Jorge in a hospital room, you know, his head bandaged completely, and the doctor is trying to tell her that her son is not going to make it. Mm. And he hands her a baggie with all his belongings in it. And anchoring a corner of that baggie is his senior ring. And I'm watching the doctor pass this to this grieving mother. It's one of the most devastating scenes, you know, of
mercy.
My career. And of course, beautiful and devastating at the same time. Mm-hmm. So Jorge, 2 or 3 days later, he dies. And it's just an incredible tragedy. Mm-hmm. We have a prayer service at school and so forth. Well, they plan his funeral for a Tuesday night. It's going to be at 7:30 at St. Teresa's Church, because that's when his community gets off work, you know? And it just so happened it coincided with the National Prayer Breakfast. And I was fortunate to be able to attend that in Washington, D.C. So I put on my suit, you know, the Monday before, fly to Washington, D.C., get up early Tuesday morning, go to the National Prayer Breakfast. And this is the leaders of not just our country, but the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the president is there, senators are there, congressmen, there, ambassadors, representatives from all sorts of countries. And it was impressive in the scale. So as soon as that's over, I hop a flight from D.C. to Little Rock and get to St. Teresa's Church in time to attend Jorge's funeral. And I had the great honor of delivering his eulogy. And it was interesting, you know, his classmates all showed up and they wore their school uniform, white shirt, senior tie, khaki pants. They filled up one side of the church. The other side was Jorge's community. was a site that is just embedded mm-hmm. in my brain, you know. And at one point in the service, it was time to say the Our Father. And half of the church said it in English and the other half said it in Spanish. Mm. And it
beautiful.
You know, yeah, it didn't, you know, they weren't trying to, you know, outpace each other or say mm-hmm. it louder or anything like that. It just blended into this one mystic, holy language. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredible to see that, you know. His classmates wept. His family embraced them. And you know, here I am wearing the exact same suit that I wore in front of the leaders of the world. I'm now wearing in front of the community of Little Rock. And some of the finest people that I've ever been around, the kids, the Jorge's community. It was powerful. And so at the end of the funeral, the boy who I was gonna fist fight in the back parking lot came up, and he was Jorge's best friend, and didn't say a word, just a slight hug. You know, it wasn't like this powerful Hallmark moment. It was just a slight hug, and that was it. And I am telling you, Adam, it was like a switch got flipped in that kid. That kid did not miss school from there on. That kid did not get in trouble in class. That kid started bringing tamales that his grandmother made to the teachers, to me. He graduated. He became, he owns his own business now. He's just a successful, good young man. Now, what happened? I mean, how did that happen? And the answer is very simple. It's that he saw the value that Jorge's community and that Jorge's school placed on him. I mean, he saw that it was real. You can't manufacture that No. kind of thing. And he saw that the community, the school, the institution that he attended placed that value on his friend. Mm-hmm. And he knew that he had that value as well. And that is a game changer in anyone's life. When you realize that, you know, I have value, like I count, that gives you hope. You know, whether you are a teenage boy or a middle-aged man or older, the moment that you can grasp that I have value, anything is possible. And it changes your perspective about life forever. Optimism reigns. And that's who this kid is now. He's still not perfect, you know. He still calls me every once in a while and gives me a hard time sure. just because that's our history. But he's a really good kid.
That's a beautiful redemptive story. And it's sounds like just Jorge's legacy
mm-hmm.
there. Tragic.
Yeah.
And at the same time, his legacy. And I like how you describe that because that's something you can talk about.
Yeah.
But until it's been experienced,
yeah.
as you described, you don't really.
Yeah.
Feel that.
Well, I think of Jorge all the time, the message, his legacy, like you said. Gosh, he was a hard worker, you know? I mean, working 40 hours a week and going to school. I mean, he was devoted to his family. You know, the whole reason why I was introduced to him is because he had something that he believed he needed to protect his family. He was contributing income to the family. And he had this, you know, belief in our institution, in something bigger than himself, mm. bigger than the individual. And that was that epitomized by that senior ring and how he said, yes, I have. I ordered my senior ring. Paid in full, of course I did, you know. I mean, if we can do that, work hard, you know, love family and each other, be part of things that are bigger than ourselves. Goodness. What a great life.
I would imagine that there's a unique weight that comes with being so radically present in students' most difficult moments. What has it meant to you over the years to move into those difficult spaces, and how do you personally shoulder that kind of grief as a leader?
Yeah. You know, you use that word presence. And as Americans, we like to fill quiet with conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not as comfortable just being. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I had to learn, is that a lot of times a kid just needs you there. They don't need to hear your advice, you know, your world wisdom or lifetime experiences. They just need you there. And, you know, that's why when the band has a concert, you're there. That's why when the football team plays, you're there. That's when the ROTC has its formations or whatever, you're there. Your just presence means so much. Because when the dark times come, mm-hmm. as they inevitably will, you have the credibility of presence. You've been there with them. And credibility today is currency. Mm-hmm. Credibility is different today. And I've learned that kids, but really people value people that they consider credible, have the credibility. Mm-hmm. So I've learned to not fill that uncomfortable void, you know, with just blather. I've learned to not go, yeah, well, when I was your age, I, you know, did this. It is a lot of listening, and it is a lot of exacting care. It is a lot of pats on the shoulders and understanding that and expressing that, you know, life is messy. If you're looking for perfection, mm-hmm. you'll lose all the good. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a process for me.
Yeah.
You know, as I told you before we started doing this, I tend to be verbose and tend to like to fill that uncomfortable minute with a lot of words. But I've learned that listening, being present, is the most important thing that you can do.
When you think about your role, not just as head of school, but as a mentor, mm-hmm. as you have been, what does it mean to teach students values like perseverance,
yeah.
empathy,
yeah.
and ultimately to become yeah. the best versions yeah. of themselves?
Yeah. I obviously am a big fan of education. Mm-hmm. I think the majority of our public schools do a great job. I think the majority of our private schools do a great job. But a school that goes from being really good to life-changing, from really good to great, is that life lessons are infused within the curriculum. Mm. And, you know, do we express why we want you to go to school on time? You know, do we articulate why it's important to stay longer if you need to? Mm-hmm. You know, we're teaching them life lessons that, yes, life demands that you show up early and stay late. Life demands that, you know, you are going to fail at some point. But what do you do after that? Mm-hmm. That's what's important. You know, it seems cliche, but we're all going to fail. That's not the important part. The important part is what you do that next moment. Mm-hmm. That is a life lesson. everything from getting along with the teachers, the authority in the room, to collaborating with your classmates, to you know, just following curiosity down a path that you never thought it would take you down. Those are life lessons. Perseverance is so important. Curiosity builds confidence, which is so important. You know, showing up early, staying late, having that strong work ethic, so important. And these are life lessons that schools are uniquely qualified to deliver. So if we go to a school just to learn, you know, math and English and science and social studies, that's fine. But gosh, what a waste. You know, the opportunity to do more is there. In most schools, I believe this with my whole heart, most schools do it and do it pretty well because they hire good people. The teachers that are in the classrooms are there for a good reason, and it's more than just math. It's more than just social studies. It's because they want to do something special in a kid's life.
Hearing you describe what you're describing in such a passionate way, it's clear that it's a calling for you. And I love how you just talked about it's not about the academics. It's not just about checking the box on these classes. You have a limited amount of time with these students, just these few years. Yeah. What do you hope that your students carry with them long after they've left, after they've gotten the ring and graduated?
Yeah, gosh, that's a great question. What I like about education is that every year has a definite start and a definite finish. And you get that moment of assessment at the end, you know? You get to see that progression. So what I like to see in teaching high school, a four-year process, I like to see where they start as 14-year-old little kids. And if we do our job right, they'll leave as 18-year-old adults, young adults. Mm-hmm. And that slow progression towards that is so endearing. What do I hope that they learn? You know, I hope that they do learn these life lessons that we just discussed. You know, I hope that they do learn that the world is a beautiful place. It is going to have its dark moments because that's what it is. But the world is a beautiful place, and that life is beautiful, and that we will have pitfalls. But, you know, when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do to get out is to drop the shovel and start reaching for the ladder. Because so many of the holes we find ourselves in are by our own hand. They've been dug by our own hand. And so I want them to learn to have grit, you know? I want them to learn to be tough. And I want them to learn those things because those things translate into the ideals that we want out of life, the love, the beauty, the passion, and so forth. You know, those are the building blocks for those things. You know, no one walks through a forest and just notices the beauty offhand. They first have to have the courage to go into the forest. Mm-hmm. And so those characteristics are, nobody is born with them. They are not, you know, just part of you. They have to be stoked. They have to be cared for, nurtured, created. And then once they're born, they have to be encouraged. And again, back to education. That's what schools are so primed to do. My kids, I'm a private school administrator. My kids have gone to Catholic schools and public schools. When we start talking about polarization, the schools have got to remain immune from it.
I'd like to talk about your home. Yeah. Now for a moment. Can you talk about the influence of your wife and and raising your kids?
Yeah.
What does being fully present look like in your own home, especially in a world, as you were mentioning earlier, vies for our constant attention?
Yeah. Well, you know, my wife is a much better person than I am, and I truly believe that. When people meet us, people instantly like her, and I kind of grow on you after you know, a few days, months, whatever.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, she is the light of any room that she walks into. She's just naturally like that, and so it won't surprise you that we met at a wedding in December of 1993, I guess it was. We got engaged in March, 3 months later. We got married in August, 5 months later. So we had been together 8 months and got married.
When you know, you know.
When you know, you know. That's what we would say to each other, but she is just an extraordinary person mm-hmm. in every way. And so after 8 months, you know, we built this life. And we will celebrate, I guess it's 31 years this August. Mm-hmm. And we've been so fortunate, you know, beautiful kids. We had 5 kids. And then we adopted our youngest, the one we were waiting for, mm-hmm. and we're able to create this family that is so woven into everything that we have ever hoped to do. You know, my job at the school or my columns in the paper or whatever, the kids, our life, so woven into that. Her, you know, job at a travel agency, you know, her experiences with taking the lead in so many things that our family does, our kids, so woven into that. Just like I said with education, you know, just being present, you know, listening. We're both a little type A, so we have to fight the urge to live their lives for them. And that's a hard thing for parents today to do. You know, you've heard the term helicopter parent. You've heard the term lawnmower parent and all these other terms. But what it boils down to is we are keenly aware that if we want our kids to not just live their lives, but to thrive in their lives, then they have got to learn how to advocate for themselves. They have to learn how to build confidence for themselves. You know, they have to learn to do for themselves. And we're there as their closest guides, most trusted guides. And we get the great honor of being part of it all. So presence is extraordinarily important in the home, of course, you know. And we're just so fortunate. Again, I married above my pay grade. I always hope that, you know, no one tells her so she doesn't figure it out and realize she could have done a lot better.
So. Amidst your varied responsibilities, you still find time to write,
yeah,
which you've noted earlier. When did this start? And what does it mean to you to be able to express yourself in that form?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that question. So when I was in high school, I had a junior English teacher named Steve Wells, who was this, you know, just talk about like a Dead Poet Society teacher.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just one of those.
Classic.
Yeah, classic. And he would have us write essays every week, and I wanted him to like mine. You know, I wanted him to say something complimentary, mm-hmm. and inevitably he would. So my senior year, English teacher was Father Tribu, and you know, the legendary principal, disciplinarian, rector of the school, and he would do the same thing. You know, you would write an essay a week and due on Friday, on Monday, or due on Monday, on Friday, he would read the ones that he thought were best, and I always just angled to get him to read mine. Like, that was the highest compliment for any of us. And so that gave me the idea to write. Yeah. Now, the columns started because when I started as principal in 2005, went through a file, found an editorial that Father Tribu had written in 1979. And it was well done, beautiful, put forth some great information. And so I thought, well, I feel like I can do that. So I would submit articles, editorials to the paper about once a quarter. I did it once. They said, oh, that's great. You should do it again. So I did it again. And so about once a quarter for several years, I would just submit a essay. And then about 8 or 9 years ago, talking to the editor there, we talked about just making it more permanent. You know, how about a spot every other week? And so we agreed to that. And so the column, the title is The Strenuous Life, mm-hmm. and it's based off of Theodore Roosevelt's mm-hmm. speech mm-hmm. about living a strenuous life, one where physical exertion, emotional exertion, spiritual exertion are all present, you know. And again, it's back to thriving. And so I said, I want to name it that after the TR speech.
And, he lived. I've read quite a bit.
He did. And so that's what I wanted mm-hmm. the column to express, is that life is so much more than just going to work every day and coming mm-hmm. home and fixing dinner. You know, there are these extraordinary aspects of life that everyone has, and we've got to notice them. And I get the great honor of articulating them. It's like wearing the same suit, you know, and in front of the president of the United States and mm-hmm. later in front of this community in Southwest Little Rock. I mean, where else does that happen, mm-hmm. you know? Being able to notice it and articulate it. That's what I wanted that column to be. About 2 or 3 years ago, I got to expand it to another column called O Little Rock. And it's just really a love letter to our city every other week. And it is, you know, talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I don't really criticize Little Rock in that column. I find Little Rock to have such great beauty and great potential that column is more about the optimistic aspects mm-hmm. of our city and how we do better and how we can be better.
Steve, before we close, are there any final thoughts or lessons you hope listeners carry with them, whether they're educators, parents, or simply someone who's trying to live intentionally?
You know, living intentionally in today's world is difficult. It is, you know, just this morning, you know, I know this is recorded, but this morning, you know, Israel has attacked Iran. There are riots and protests in Los Angeles, a military parade tomorrow. It's complicated, you know, but I truly believe that there is not more hate or anger in the world. It's just more accessible. Mm-hmm. And so what I have learned is that if you pick up the weapons of your enemy, you become like him. If you pick up bigotry or extremism or dehumanization, you become like your enemy. You become your enemy. But likewise, if you pick up the tools of those who inspire you, you become like him. If you pick up compassionate accountability, if you pick up grace, if you pick up strength, you become that. So to live intentionally, we have to choose wisely. Never the tools of our enemy, always the tools of those who inspire us. The weapons of our enemies will destroy us. The tools of those who inspire us will build us up. That creates intentional living. That creates a thriving life. That creates just the beauty that we talk about, that we just talked about, and the courage to go after it. So I'm an optimist. I truly am. I think the world is complicated right now, but at its core, it is still beautiful.
Steve Straisley, I've truly enjoyed our conversation today.
Thank you
for being on the Hopecast.
Thanks for having me.